This is Steve Robbins here, host of the Get It Done Guy podcast, and I'm here with Stuart Diamond, the author of Getting More. I saw him speak at the Wharton Club a couple of months ago and was completely impressed with his negotiating tactics and strategies and his whole approach, and I've asked him to come and talk some about that. So welcome, Stuart.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In your book, you say that negotiations are everywhere. I think of negotiations as something where, oh my gosh, I have a new contract that I have to work out with my employee, and how do I do that? Could you talk a little bit about how do I think about that?
Negotiation is actually much broader than that. It's the basic process of human interaction. Every time two people interact, consciously or unconsciously, verbally or nonverbally, there's negotiation going on. Somebody is trying to persuade somebody of something, whether you're driving down the street, talking with your kids or your family. On the job in diplomacy. You can't get away from it. You can only do it well or badly. Now, people don't know this. That is the basic social process. It's somewhat similar to how math is the basic process of science and engineering. Can you imagine if scientists and engineers didn't know to study math? They wouldn't get very far. Well, most people don't deal with negotiation very well in terms of a lifelong skill, and if you look around at the world from terrorism to Charlie Sheen, you see the results of that.
Indeed. So let's just say for a minute that I did study it as a lifelong skill. What are the areas of my life that I would expect to see going differently?
Okay, you would see everything going differently. You would find you'd get discounts in stores. You'd find that your kids would listen to you. You'd find that you get into restaurants that are closed. You'd find that you get on the planes at a cheaper rate without having to pay a change fee. You'd find out you get raises at your jobs. You'd get tremendous differences in your life. The average executive in my courses makes $1 million in 14 weeks. The average student in law or business school makes about $10,000. Google's made more than $1 billion. And people get their four-year-olds to willingly go to sleep and brush their teeth. And so it's counterintuitive. It's based on psychology. And what I do in Getting More is a lot different than what passes for negotiation today. I've taught 30,000 people in 45 countries over 20 years, including at Harvard and Wharton, where I'm a professor now, and lots of other places. And I found out that the basic process of human interaction doesn't work. The threats, the walking out, the power, and all that sort of thing. And so I found a different way that people could deal with each other, and it's done things like solve the writer's strike and the other kinds of things that I mentioned.
So is this stuff, I know that in business school, when I was at Harvard, they taught us decision trees and game theory and analytics. Is that what you're talking about here?
No, that is outdated and not really very helpful. What's helpful is focusing on the other people and their emotions, on valuing them, understanding their perceptions, understanding the pictures in their head, and dealing with their emotions. That's where the action is. For example, in big negotiations, people get emotional, whether it's world peace, a billion-dollar deal, or my kid wants an ice cream cone. Analytical tools, the prisoner's dilemma, decision trees, are useless in those situations. And in fact, most negotiations people care about are big negotiations. What you have to do instead is understand people's emotions and give them what's called emotional payments, an apology, concession, I understand, listening to them, trying to understand where their emotion is coming from. If I'm feeling beat upon from what happened yesterday, if I'm feeling that you're bigfooting my company, if I'm feeling unfairly treated, I don't want to know about win-win. I don't want to know about your spreadsheets. In fact, I don't know anything about you unless you make me feel better. And the failure to do that is the root cause of most conflict in the world today. So in other words, the right answer to the statement, I hate you, is tell me more. Because you then tap in to somebody else's psyche and get them to feel valued. One of the big problems in the current debate over the U.S. Budget is that the parties are demonizing each other. How do you possibly get somebody to agree with you when all you do is insult them?
And that's really all that's going on.
Right.
So they...
and that's the case with families and the store. I'll tell you an interesting story. I had a student, a former student, came up to Philly from Houston on a plane during a snowstorm. Plane was 4 hours late. The rest of the passengers were snarling at the flight crew. This former student of mine went to the flight crew, apologized for everybody else's behavior, and said it must be a real drag to work an extra 4 hours on a day like today. And when he got off the plane, they gave him $600.
Wow.
He was the only person on the plane who got a free ticket because he made a human connection. When you make a human connection with somebody, they are 6 times more likely to do what you want. 90% versus 16%. It's not even close. And I know that one of the things you're interested in is in one-time hardball negotiations.
Yep.
Even in one-time negotiations, people like to give things to those that are nice to them. You know, you go to the rental counter at a car rental place. The person behind the counter is mean. You should think, maybe it's not about me. Maybe the last customer was mean to this person. So you say, are you having a bad day? Can I help? And you'll find as often as not it was something other than you. So as in one case in Los Angeles, you know, the person behind the counter said, you know, the last person was really a joke, a jerk, and my student said, that's really too bad. I hope the rest of your day is better. And she said, what can I do for you? And he said, how about an upgrade? And she said, how about 3 upgrades?
Excellent. So it really pays back, not just in terms of smoothing over the existing, like the existing terms, but in getting more.
That's exactly right. I had a couple of students that were in separate rooms in a resort in the Caribbean. There's a really loud band. The first one went down and started berating the desk clerk for having a loud band. Of course, it wasn't the desk clerk's fault. Desk clerk said, jump in the light. Next person went down independently an hour later and said, it's really too bad you have to listen to this every night. Gee, I wish you didn't. Can I do anything to help? Could you help me out at all? And they upgraded that person to a quiet suite on the other side of the hotel. And so you're being decent to people when the rest of the world is being a jerk is a competitive advantage.
Interesting. And I know one of the things that I've heard when people talk about empathizing with someone else's position is the ratio between talking and listening. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Really, the negotiation is you need to find out what's in people's head in order to persuade them. You can't persuade them unless you listen to them and find out what's in their head. Most people just assume they know what's in the other party's head, and they come with their proposal. If somebody asks me for my proposal at a negotiation, I'll say, I have no idea. What's in the deal? What are your needs? So it's mostly about them, because them's the one you have to persuade. You know, you're the least important person in the negotiation. Most important person is them, and the second most important person is third parties. And if you begin to get the ego out and to start focusing on the other side, that's really key. I've got a 9-year-old son. I'm always giving him stuff without him asking. I know that he wants more control over his life, so I let him pick the restaurant. I let him leave his room dirty a little bit. I let him go to bed a little bit later. You know why? Because now he constantly owes me stuff. And so when I ask him to do something for me, he doesn't want to do it. I say, didn't Daddy do A, B, and C for you? And if you think that's manipulative, I asked him about it. He said, no, I don't feel manipulated. I get stuff all the time. And so that's his point of view. So I'm looking for ways to give people stuff so they'll give me stuff. It's a backwards way that most people do it, but it's much more effective.
Well, would you mind going to a specific application that just might be relevant?
Yeah, well, let me talk about the writer's strike for
Please. A
moment, because that really is, I think, a seminal kind of event. About 3 years ago now, I got a call from Ari Emanuel, who is probably the most foremost agent in Hollywood. He's the brother of Rahm Emanuel, who was chief of staff of the White House, now mayor of Chicago, and he is the role model for Ari Gold on Entourage, the agent. And the writer's strike had been going on for 3 months. They had no contract for a year. And he wanted me to help. I met him through some mutual acquaintances. And so he got me on the phone with the negotiators for the Writers Guild and some other agents, and they wanted some advice for what to do in one of their interminable meetings with the studio heads, which was occurring in a couple of days for breakfast. They wanted to know about royalty rates and other substantive issues. And I said, forget all the substantive issues. Go to the meeting and ask three questions. Question number one is, are you guys happy? Oh, we're not happy. Question two is, you're making any money? We're not making any money. Question number three was, if you had to do this over again, what process would you use? It took them 30 minutes to restart the negotiations, and it took them 2 days to get a deal. So I can say a couple of things about this. First, it's not rocket science. And second, unless you already know how to do it, it's completely invisible. And so making those connections, you know, with the NFL, with actors and producers, with the U.S. and Iran, what they need to be doing is saying to each other, you know, before we sit down to formally negotiate, how do you feel? You like pizza? What are some of your favorite movies? Now, that's what's required. People often ask me, what should they do in the Middle East? And I say, they need to do lunch. That's what they need to do. Lunch, if they'd done lunch for 2 years, they'd be farther along than they are now. And people skip that step, and in a world in which there's a lot of risk, trust is pretty important.
Absolutely. Now, with people you already know well, let's say a spouse or your nine-year-old, one could say that the relationship is already in place just because of the context.
Oh, but you can wreck the relationship by not figuring out their needs. And that happens with divorces, it happens with kids that are recalcitrant. And so I need to pay attention to their needs all the time. It's not something that you can or should turn on and off. It's something that, you know, life is about quid pro quo. And you can use it in all kinds of situations. I mean, a kind of a funny one that we have around the house is my wife loves to garden, and she especially loves to garden with me, and I hate to garden, and I hate to garden with my wife, as everybody knows, who knows me, because she's too bossy. But I've decided that I will garden with my wife anytime she asks in return for 3 uninterrupted hours in front of the television set anytime during the year a professional football game happens to be on. So I'm open for trade, and we trade stuff. We trade stuff all the time. And that's, you know, an essence of a good relationship is meeting each other's needs by trading things. And so that works in a business situation, and it works in a personal situation. And I don't limit the negotiation to the four corners of what the deal is about. You know, there are all kinds of things you can trade. The CEO of a major company in Philadelphia once told me the most important thing he ever did for his major client in a 20-year business relationship was to pick up the client's CEO's mother-in-law at the Philadelphia airport one Saturday night. Has nothing to do with any deal, but it affects every deal.
Right, because it strengthens the relationship. And it sounds like that also made it transcend business and move all the way to the personal.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing is, if people don't like you, they won't buy your products even if they're better. If people like you, they will buy your products even if inferior.
Sure. So the question is how to get everyone to like us.
Well, you start by saying, who is this person? What are they about? What turns them on? What turns them off?
It seems like in the world of Google and LinkedIn, you should be able to even get in that information prior to meeting someone just by...
Yes, without seeming that you've been too intrusive on their life. I tend to start gingerly, incrementally. I mean, you know, my favorite opening in a negotiation is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to just talk very gradually about why we're here.
And so you're listening. When you ask what's going on, you don't just mean... Hi, what are your terms? You're asking what's going on, and you're listening for the emotional things, the human connection,
right,
as well.
And I will often find things that I can put into the deal that would not otherwise be in the deal. A daughter that needs computer help, a recommendation for a hotel in the Caribbean, the things that bring people together, a recipe for cookies. And you think this is stupid, but it's people that people make deals with. And in fact, in a pinch, you worry about the loyalty of other people in a business deal. And that's how you increase the kind of connections that engender loyalty.
Now, when you bring in these alternate currencies, like the recipe for chocolate chip cookies, do you actually bring it in as, gee, I can throw this in? Or do you do that kind of separately and say, hey, as part of our emotional connection, I'll give you the chocolate chip cookies. Now let's go back to the main.
It depends how directly related to the deal it is. Most of the time, I just bring it in and I talk about, you know, that I've got this thing for them and so forth, and I wait to see if I get something back. I use it to build a relationship. I'm not so crass as to sort of say, I'm giving you a recipe, give me a deal. Mm-hmm. Because it's a small thing, but it's a signal. It's a signal that I care about them. On the other hand, in a deal, here's a really great story. If you were to go to Williams-Sonoma, the wine company in California, you took a tour, you'd see a rather shabby office down the hall with a guy sitting in it who's 97 years old with his feet up on his desk reading catalogs. And that's Mr. Williams, who sold his vineyards to the Sonoma Company 30 years ago at 67. And he said, I'm not selling this company unless I can die at my desk. I want to do anything I want in my office until the time I die. And they did the deal. That's something that's more explicit that wouldn't normally be part of a deal.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine it's hard for me to imagine any traditional negotiation bringing that up.
That's exactly right. It's the stuff that closes deals. At the end of the day, money is only a proxy for human needs, which is not to say it's not important, but the best deals need intangibles. They need things other than money to close the best deals. I mean, Reagan and Gorbachev got along, and that hastened the fall of the Soviet Union.
What if there really is a substantive disagreement where I simply disagree with you about the way we're thinking about the situation? I mean, let's say the mosque at Ground Zero.
There's a couple of things. The first thing I want to know is, can we trade anything off for it? So, you know, I might say, if I were the Muslims, I would say, you don't want a mosque at Ground Zero, and it's my right to have one there. Fine, give me $5 million to build one uptown, or you know, you can trade off things like this. Or you can use standards. What's fair here? What did we all agree would be fair? In other words, we have some laws, we have some guidelines we all swore that we'd live by. What do they say? And so what I want to know is, an America that says we are not going to be tolerant of these people who are not breaking the law because I feel bad, what kind of Pandora's box is that?
So,
and are we prepared to set that standard for everybody?
Interesting. So by standards, you mean the principles that we have declared, this is how we're going to
exactly.
Our conduct.
I want to know what their standards are. Martin Luther King made it really uncomfortable for people when he said, now this is the Constitution that everybody lives by. Doesn't it say that we get these rights? And so how come you're violating your own Constitution? I learned this as a journalist. It's extremely powerful. Tim Russert, the late, great Tim Russert, used to do it on Meet the Press when he put up politicians' previous statements and showed how their current statements didn't match them and made them really uncomfortable by pointing this out. And so what I learned is find out their standards. What has the company promised in terms of customer service? What did they say about customer satisfaction? Have they ever made any exceptions that I can fit within? And so their standard is a really powerful way of dealing with hard bargainers. Gandhi took away India from Britain without raising his voice or raising a weapon simply by saying, your standard in Britain is not to slaughter people. Isn't that right? You have a different standard for India? It's a tremendously powerful tool.
How do you find out someone's standards?
First of all, they publish them usually. They've got mission statements. They've got websites. They've got speeches. Second, you ask them. Third, you do research.
So this is really about finding out the missions of the organizations, the values.
And I tend to be pretty incremental. For example, I will go into a store and I'll say, do you like your customers to come back? How do you get them to come back? How do you treat them? And if I go through this litany with them and they tell me that they treat their customers well, then I say, well, here's how I was treated. So it's either something they've published before or something that you set for the negotiation. I've been in negotiations, labor management negotiations, where I said in the beginning, how about these standards? No spitting, no cursing, no walking out. Put them up on the board, and then the first time somebody does that, we say, aren't you a man of your word? Didn't you say those things on the wall? And so it causes people to be a little bit more reasonable. And what's also good about the things that I mentioned, I think, in getting more that I've learned from research is these are transparent. They're not manipulative. If somebody says, are you using standards on me? I'll say, absolutely. What's wrong with all of your well-considered standards as a basis for judgment? I'll tell them what I'm doing.
Because all you're really doing is holding them to the very structure of the relationship that they have walked in claiming they...
Exactly. And the world's an unfair place, and people violate their standards all the time.
What do you do when someone has caught you violating your standards?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, I pay up. I mean, negotiation, the way I practice it, is not that I win everything. You know, it's about getting more, not getting everything. And if it's fair, I want a reputation for being fair. Second, I want to know if I can trade something off for it. And third, I want to find out if the standard is exactly what I promised. Because sometimes, you know, standards are exceptions. Sometimes they are only in certain kinds of situations. And frankly, sometimes I made a mistake. And I'll tell people that. But I've got to be careful how I use that.
Right. The very fact that you're willing to say I made a mistake sounds already like you're going someplace a lot of people never go.
Exactly. And you find that you get all kinds of things from people in many different situations. As I said, getting seats on a train that you didn't think had. I have three students in the book who brought planes back after they'd already left the gate, and that sort of thing.
You mentioned something just in passing a minute ago about moving incrementally. I, you know, when I heard of negotiation in business school, one of the things they say is, oh, you start by taking a really extreme position and asking for
more.
Oh, that's so stupid.
You take an extreme position. You get people emotional. They think they can't possibly do the deal because it's too big of a distance to go. And when you start backing off, they don't trust you anymore. It's just ridiculous. What you want to do is figure out what the standards are that they can accept, and you move in very small steps toward them, especially in a risky world. The more incremental you are, the better off you are. And again, something that's on my mind these days and is on many Americans' minds is the national debt. Why do we need to solve this problem in a month? Why can't we solve this problem in a year? You know, close to deadlines, the quality of agreements declines. Why don't we do $1 billion a day? Why don't we do something smaller? And you'll find in the Middle East, if they had one factory with Arabs and Jews 30 years ago, they'd have economic peace today. If they had one health clinic in the United States 30 years ago and they scaled it up, they'd have a good health care plan today. The technology industry has learned about scalability. The political system is not, nor has personal life, it seems.
This is so foreign to a lot of what we're taught, which is come in, stand by, you know, come in, ask for what you want, and then basically hold your ground.
Yes, but watch kids. Can I have a cookie? Well, can I have a half a cookie? Can I have a quarter of a cookie? Can I have a crumb of a cookie? Kids get this. And so when I deal with my son, I say, well, if you won't clean your whole room today, would you clean a quarter of your room today and clean another quarter of your room tomorrow? And you know something? In 3 days, the room's clean. And he learns something about persuasion.
He's going to be a force to be reckoned with by the time he's
an adult. He already is.
Is there anything you'd like to add that you haven't mentioned that you think people should walk away with?
I think that one of the last questions you had that was very interesting is about persistence. You ask for extra pillows at a hotel. They make a half-hearted attempt to do it, and then you don't know what else to do. Well, there's a couple of things. You know, goals are very important in negotiation. You need to know where you're headed, and people can eventually figure that out. But what they don't realize is commitment at the end of the negotiation is very important. Unless you get a commitment from somebody in the way that they make commitments, you don't have a deal. An unfortunate Swiss company got a contract signed with a company in Egypt. The company in Egypt broke the contract, so the Swiss company thought, and the Swiss company called up the Egyptian company and complained, and the Egyptian company said there was no contract, and the Swiss company said, what do you mean? And the Egyptian said, we didn't shake on it.
Ah.
The way they make commitments is shaking hands. And so you need to know how they make commitments. And so getting somebody's name, finding out when they'll bring the pillows, finding out who's responsible, finding out who's the decision maker, and then you call them over and over again. My favorite book in the English language on persistence is Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham. After 105 requests, Sam I Am eats the green eggs and ham. And the person who asked does it with such a lovely, humorous, wry way of looking at the world, nobody could be mad at him.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, do you just ask people outright, how do you make commitments?
You bet. And I also ask people, what am I doing wrong in trying to persuade you? Advise me. I'm not doing a good job.
That's one of the things I found really striking about your book that I haven't heard anyone else address, is you talk about commenting on the process while the process is going on.
That's right. Clearly people are just trying to meet their goals, and most people don't want to hurt anybody else in the process. And that's why I think that both sides can get more by having a reasonable conversation on what this all looks like. So many people have learned wrongly you can only get what you want by hiding things from people, by manipulating them, by being tough with them. That's not true. The whole history of the human race has been one of expanding the pie, of getting more through mutual collaboration in the best situations. And that's what getting more is about.
You talk about calling people out on their bad behavior, which to me seems really scary. Like, I'm afraid, oh my gosh, if I say to the person, gee, are you playing hardball because you think you can force me into taking less than my minimum? I'm afraid to say that because I'm thinking, oh, if I call them out on this, then they'll walk away entirely and everything will fall apart.
First of all, it depends on your tone, and second of all, it depends on practice. Certainly, to pick something that's stereotypical, if you're a very attractive person dealing with somebody from the opposite sex and you say it with a smile, they will stick around in the conversation. And so is the right negotiator saying this, number one. And number two, practice being a little bit more tactful and see what works for you. This is not, the getting more is not intended to have everybody be like me. It's intended for people to be themselves better. And so you've got a list of principles and you say, I want to practice saying, I'm really uncomfortable that dinner's taken a little longer than I expected. What can you tell me about that? Now, that's something that could go down all right, but that's what I mean, is you do something that's comfortable, take a little bit of a chance, see what happens, practice, debrief yourself, do it again.
You're also recommending a learning experience here.
It is a learning experience. I'm a better negotiator than I was 10 years ago because I'm constantly debriefing myself and figuring out what I did wrong and then doing it again. And I don't even have to do it in real time. I can just think about it. I can read the paper, I can watch people, and it gets to be kind of funny after a while. My friends used to make fun of me by doing this until I started getting their needs met. Then they stopped laughing at me.
This has really been wonderful. I think you've certainly met my needs. Has this met your needs?
It has. I love your questions, and I look forward to hearing the podcast.
What can I do to make this most successful for you?
I think people know the name of the book, Getting More. I think if they knew the website, that might help. It's www.gettingmore.com. And Getting More is one word. We have a whole bunch of additional stories and advice on the website people can check out.
And I know you also have a Twitter account.
Yes, @Stuart Diamond.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your taking the time for us today.
Liked it very much, Steve. Good luck to you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Stever Robbins and Stuart Diamond. You can find Stever on the web at steverrobbins.com, and you can find Stuart on the web at gettingmore.com. Work less, do more, and have great negotiations.